Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, our lecture is presented by the Boston University School of Theology and Office of Development and Alumni Relations in association with the Lowell Institute. Our speaker is Bishop Mel Talbert. Bishop Talbert's lecture is titled Human Rights, Dissenting Action, and Civil Discourse. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, School of Theology Dean Mary Elizabeth Moore.
Bishop Talbert is a man who speaks from the depths and centers of his heart. He is a man who has such integrity that when the United Methodist Church tries to censor him for the roles he's taken in most recent times, the Black Methodists for Church Renewal and other groups publicly proclaim that they will stand behind him, stand beside him. Bishop Talbert grew up in Louisiana. His first degree was in secondary education. When he experienced the call to ministry in college, he went to seminary, but he went to seminary to prove to himself and others that he was not called to ordained ministry. Lo and behold, he was. So he completed seminary, he was ordained, and he began serving churches. Also during this period, he became active in the student nonviolent SNCC. In 1960, he helped organize sit-ins in Atlanta, the very first sit-ins. Martin Luther King Jr. joined in those sit-ins, and they shared a jail cell for a few days. In 1980, after serving churches in the California Pacific Annual Conference, Melvin Talbert was elected bishop. He served in two different annual conferences, the Pacific Northwest and Northern California, Nevada. He also served in roles that I want you to be aware of, because he has been very active as a leader in ecumenical affairs as well as in the denomination. He served as secretary of the Council of Bishops. That's in the United Methodist Church. He served as president of the National Council of Churches of Christ, USA. He attended every general conference of the United Methodist Church since 1968, and that itself is heroic. Before being elected bishop, in addition to serving local churches, he was the executive secretary for the General Board of Discipleship and led that board in major new directions. He also, in retirement, has served a four-year term as the ecumenical officer for the Council of Bishops and as president of the Churches Uniting in Christ, the CUIC. He served as adjunct professor of United Methodist Polity and Practice at Vanderbilt University, where he still serves, by the way, and as executive director of the National Black Methodist for Church Renewal from 2004 to 2007. I would call that a very active retirement. I share this because I want you to be aware that this man is not only a leader within a denomination. He is an ecumenical leader. And he is a fearless, fearless prophet for racial, gender, and sexual orientation inclusiveness. He believes, and this is a direct quote, there is room at God's table for everyone. Let us welcome our guest, Bishop Talbert, and let us be prepared to ground ourselves in this holy place at this holy moment.
Distinguished faculty, students, staff, guests, and friends of Boston University School of Theology, sisters and brothers, I extend to you warm greetings in the name and in the spirit of Jesus Christ. Now, the intersection of oppression and privilege. In this lecture, which is not intended to be a scholarly treatise, I can only scratch the surface of the issues and concerns underlying the topic that I shall discuss. The intersection of oppression and privilege is a reality for all of us. The question is, how do we embrace that reality in a way that fosters the beloved community envisioned by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? After prayer for reflection, I came to the conclusion that it would be most beneficial for me to approach this subject out of my own experience as a person of color, a person who has known oppression. My oppression had to do with race. An African American born and lived through a time when Jim Crow law was my reality and my church sanctioned my oppression. I learned early in life that race prejudice is a reality for all races, not just white folk. In my early life, I hated white people who did such terrible things to us. Each of us is guilty of race prejudice and race bias. In the book Set Free, A Journey Toward Solidarity Against Racism, I found this statement that sums up my experiences of oppression, and I quote, "Racism is not the same as racial prejudice. Where racial prejudice is held by many of us, regardless of our skin color, racism is only present when a given group in society has the power to enforce their prejudices so that they receive more benefits and privileges than other groups. Racism equals race prejudice plus the misuse of systemic power. In my early days, in the sit-in demonstration days, in the South, we understood racism to be prejudice plus power. So we had to learn how to deal with prejudice plus power at the point that it intersected with our oppression. Now, these authors conclude that racism is like an iceberg afloat in the sea of life in our society. Racism is not as one-dimensional as the definition suggests. It can be found in three primary manifestations: individual, institutional, and systemic. Likewise, each of these manifestations has three levels: oppressive power, white power, and identity power. Let's take a quick look at this racism iceberg. Oppressive power of racism is what we see and what we experience. It's the visible acts that are part of the larger system which says that people of color are not human. So it's all right to hurt them and to deny them basic human rights of equal access to benefits and privileges. And some examples of oppressive power of racism are separate but equal, public accommodations, churches, and schools. I can still see in my mind those white-only, colored-only signs. I can still feel the sting of oppression that was so evident in those early years. Other manifestations were denying equal opportunity for employment for people of color in every aspect of society. But the other level is white power. You don't see it. It's underneath the surface, but that's the core of racism. It is where racism's purpose resides, because racism is not really about hurting people of color. It is about giving privilege and power to white people. Within the system of racism, white people are superior. things that happen at the tip of the iceberg, the oppressive power, happen because of the core. Some examples of this level of power are the enactment of laws to make legal the right of white people to discriminate based on race. So the white-only, the colored-only signs were legal and were vigorously enforced by law enforcement personnel. To violate such laws could result in being arrested and jailed with severe and extreme penalties, whether you were colored, quote, or white. But the most damaging level of racism is at the base of the iceberg. Here, racism claims the power to tell people of color and white people who they are. As we all know, God has already solved this problem. We are all part of the family of God, no exceptions. Yet, racism attempts to usurp the authority of God. It is at the identity level that racism begins to shape us and tells us what to think and what to feel about others. From the early 1950s to the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, the civil rights struggle was about dissolving the racism iceberg. It was about challenging the status quo of racial segregation and reframing the issue of race to a new level of understanding that all human beings are created in the image of God. Thus, black people began believing that they were somebody. They began believing and feeling that they were equal and had a right to all the basic human dignity and freedoms in civil society. It was through this struggle that I became the person that I am today. During the sit-in demonstrations in the summer of 1960, I made that commitment to nonviolence, which meant that I would sit in white public accommodations and refuse to leave. I was willing to be arrested and go to jail to protest the immoral and unjust laws of separate but equal. I was arrested and spent jail time in the same cell with Dr. King. Now, those hours with Dr. King changed my life. I became convinced that Gandhi's concept of soul force, love, was the greatest resource for bringing about change in the world. And Dr. King challenged us to let love be the motivating influence in our lives. He reminded us that Jesus was all about love. Love your enemies. Love your neighbor. Do good to those who mistreat you. Turn the other cheek. Now, throughout my ministry, when faced with challenging or difficult issues or decisions, I inevitably found myself being reminded of my commitment to nonviolence and to the encounter with Dr. King. When we as angry black radicals expressed our hate of white people, I shall never forget how Dr. King kept reminding us that Bull Connors and George Wallace were our brothers. On one occasion, he looked at me and said, "Melvin Talbot, you know better because George Wallace is a Methodist." I have frequently stated that Dr. King was the greatest ally white America ever had, even though publicly he was excoriated and criticized and rejected. But he was the greatest ally white America ever had because he refused to embrace the rhetoric of hate espoused by some black leaders. So I stand before you tonight, and I declare boldly that all of you are my sisters and brothers. We're members of the one family, the human family, the family of God. I further declare that racism is a sin against God and humanity. Racism is an evil that must be identified, addressed, and eradicated from our community. However, our most recent presidential election is a reminder that racism is still alive and well in every aspect of our society. The unfinished task and challenge of eradicating racism is still before us. But my experience of racism suggests that there are other icebergs afloat in the sea of humanity and deserve some in-depth exploration in our churches and in society. Two of these icebergs are heterosexism, sexism, and sexism. First, the iceberg of heterosexism. As a matter of personal confession, I am not gay. I'm straight. So I have some deep reservations regarding my effort to share perspectives on what it's like to be a person of a different sexual orientation or gender identity. But I have known oppression. So I do claim my capacity to empathize and to proclaim what I understand to be God's truth of who we are as human beings. Without exception, we are each part of God's family. As heterosexuals of every race and culture, we have our prejudices and biases regarding persons with different sexual orientation and gender identity. And I'm sure that persons of different sexual orientation or gender identity have their prejudices and biases regarding heterosexual. But like racism, heterosexism is not the same as heterosexual prejudice. Heterosexism is heterosexual prejudice plus power. It is the misuse of heterosexual systemic power. And my contention is that we as heterosexuals must explore the depth of heterosexism for the purpose of intentionally taking steps to rid ourselves of the sin of heterosexism that plagues us as a church and as society. Now, using the iceberg analogy, heterosexism has three primary manifestations: individual, institutional, systemic. And likewise, each of these manifestations have three levels: oppressive power, heterosexual power, and identity power. The oppressive power of heterosexism is the visible acts or expressions that hurt persons of a different sexual orientation or gender identity and denies them their basic human rights and full access to all benefits and privileges. And some examples of oppressive power of heterosexism are, number one, the killing of Matthew Shepard. That's individual manifestation. The United Methodist Church enshrining incompatibility language in its book of discipline. That's institutional manifestation. And churches and other groups coercing gay and lesbian persons to go through brainwashing processes to enable them to become heterosexual. That's systemic manifestation. Now, of course, heterosexual power is the core of heterosexism. This is the place where heterosexism's purpose resides. Heterosexism is not really about hurting persons of a different sexual orientation or gender identity. It is about giving privilege and power to the heterosexuals. Now, within the system of heterosexism, heterosexual people are superior. The things that happen at the tip of the iceberg, the oppressive power level, happen because of the core. Some examples of heterosexual power are characterizing all gay persons as immoral. That's individual. Churches not ordaining persons of different sexual orientation or gender identity. That's institutional. Only heterosexual lifestyles portrayed in church literature or magazines. That's systemic. Now, identity power is the base of the iceberg. It is the most damaging level of heterosexualism. It is heterosexism claiming the power to tell heterosexual persons and persons with different sexual orientation or gender identity who they are. Heterosexism attempts to usurp the authority of God. It is at the identity power level that heterosexism begins to shape us and to tell us what to think and what to feel about ourselves. Some examples of identity power are heterosexuals proclaiming they are not prejudiced, but simply doing what is just and right by condemning the lifestyles of persons with different sexual orientation and gender identities. That's an individual manifestation. Involving or using persons of different sexual orientation or gender identity to overtly oppose the full inclusion of persons with different sexual orientation or gender identity in churches or in society. That's institutional manifestation. And corporations or churches refusing to portray persons with different sexual orientation or gender identity in society in a positive manner. That's systemic manifestation. Now, in the midst of the 1970s, while serving as General Secretary of the newly created General Board of Discipleship, I accepted the invitation to participate in a very special event and engagement in an interaction in Boston, here in Boston, Massachusetts. Participants were told in advance that the group of 30 or more would be a mixture of gay and straight, persons from various sectors of society. The event began Friday evening with dinner and ended with lunch on Sunday. The covenant was to share only our name and the place from which we came. We were not to reveal our vocation or sexual identity until the final session on Sunday morning. Needless to say, at that time, I was homophobic. I brought with me to this occasion all of my biases and stereotypes regarding people who were homosexuals. So throughout that experience, even though we were told to simply engage the process, I decided that I could pick them out. I knew who they were by my own biases and prejudices. But when we were invited to participate and to share our sexual identity and vocations on Sunday morning, I was blown away. All of my stereotypes were shattered. And that day, I made a commitment to God and myself that I would never again discriminate against another person because of their sexual orientation. And that was the beginning of my journey to who I am today. Out of my own experience, I've come to the realization that homosexuals and heterosexuals of persons of sacred worth and must be granted their full human and civil rights. So I declare to you this day that persons of different sexual orientation or gender identity are members of the family of God, and heterosexuals have no legal or theological grounds on which to declare otherwise. Heterosexism is a sin and an evil that must be identified, confronted, and eradicated from the community. And like racism, heterosexism is an iceberg afloat in our relationships that's in need of thawing and melting so that our rights and privileges can be shared equally and freely as members of the family of God. And now the third iceberg. A third iceberg afloat in our sea of relationship is sexism. I was born and raised in a male-dominated society. That was true in every aspect of my community, the church, the government, the schools, etc. Irrespective of the intellect and competence of women, men had the right and the privilege to prescribe certain roles for women. And that was true for men of every race and culture. And may I suggest that the same held true for men who were part of the gay community. In reality, men of all races and all different sexual orientation or gender identities have prejudices and biases toward women, just as women have biases and prejudices toward men. But sexism is not the same as sexist prejudice. Sexism is sexist prejudice plus power. It is the misuse of sexist systemic power. And my contention is that men with the historic weight of tradition and culture and religion on their side must be open to exploring the depths of our sexism so that the purpose of intentionally, so sexism for the purpose of intentionally taking steps to rid ourselves of the sin and evil of sexism that plagues the church and society. Again, using the iceberg analogy, sexism has three primary manifestations: individual, institutional, and systemic. Likewise, each of these manifestations has three levels: oppressive power, sexist power, and identity power. The oppressive power of sexism is what we see. It is the visible acts or expressions that hurt women of all races or different sexual orientation and gender identity, and deny them their basic human rights and full access to benefits and privileges. For some reason, men tend to justify their acts of injustice and discrimination against women. An example of the oppressive power of sexism is a district superintendent reporting to a bishop that a congregation does not want a woman pastor appointed to the congregation, or a corporation or institution continuing to sustain the invisible glass ceiling that never allow women to break through. A classic example is the most recent selection of leadership for the committees of the U.S. Congress. I want you to watch the next picture that you see. When the speaker comes out, he will have the lone woman walking with him, but right behind him is a long trail of white men. Sexist power is the core of sexism. It is where sexism's purpose resides, because sexism is not really about hurting women. It's about giving privilege and power to men. Within the system of sexism, men are superior to women. The things that happen at the tip of the iceberg, the oppressive power, happen because of the core. Now, while serving as an active bishop, some district superintendents reported to me that churches did not want a woman pastor. Now, of course, those reports were not the final word. The cabinet and I had a strategy for dealing with such reports. First, the cabinet and I were clear that we would not tolerate discrimination against women. Even though we expected open and honest sharing from the churches, we made it clear that our decision-making process would not be determined by the reports from the churches. Rather, if the bishop and the cabinet concluded that the person possessing the gifts and graces for leading their congregation was a woman, their requests for not receiving a woman would not be considered until after they had a consultation with the person we had selected as the best possible choice for that congregation. I'm pleased to report that my cabinet and I never lost a battle. For you see, once people come face to face with the unknown that is another human being, something magical happens. The human dynamic of love and justice and grace turn fear into redemptive action. Identity power is the base of the iceberg. It is the most damaging level of sexism. It is men claiming the power to tell women and other men who they are. Sexism attempts to usurp the authority of God, and it is at the identity power level that sexism shapes men and women and tells us what we think and how we feel about ourselves. And some examples of identity power are men proclaiming they are not prejudiced against women, but they are simply claiming their God-given right to be men. Individual manifestation. Involving and using women to overtly oppose the full inclusion of women in churches and other institutions in society. Institutional manifestation. And churches and other institutions refusing to portray women in a positive manner in all levels of leadership in church and in society. Systemic manifestation. Like racism and heterosexism, sexism is an iceberg afloat in the sea of our human experiences in every aspect of our society. It is an evil and a sin against humanity. It must be identified, confronted, and eradicated so that our human relationships can flourish without serious interruptions. So in conclusion, I'm deeply indebted to the authors of the book Set Free, A Journey Toward Solidarity Against Racism. Too often, we find ourselves dealing with symptoms. The iceberg concept suggests that in human relations, greater efforts should be placed on probing the depths to explore a broader understanding of what causes us to do things and to do the things that we do to each other. During this week of remembering the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we hold before us his vision for a beloved community. It is my contention that the beloved community cannot be realized without focusing attention on the loaded icebergs of racism, heterosexism, and sexism afloat in our midst. Now, in this lecture, I have presented three distinct cases for issues which lead to the intersection of oppression and privilege. I've not said anything about power. It is my experience that power has been both enabling and controlling. It has been abusive and empowering. Yet, in each of the three cases I used in this session are used in an abusive manner. In each of these cases, power has become corrupt. Quoting the English philosopher Edmund Burke, Dr. King frequently said, "All that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good men, and I say good people, to do nothing." Now, my sisters and brothers, from the beginning, evil existed in the world. And you and I know that there's a lot of evil lurking in our lives today. And as people of faith, we are called by God to be part of the force for good in the world so that evil will not triumph. And it is my prayer that God's Spirit will prod us into being active agents for the common good of all creation. May we use all of our resources, all of our power, to eradicate the sin and evil of racism, heterosexism, and sexism from all of our relationships in society, and especially in our church. Thank you.
Our respondent is Will Green, who's a student, an MDiv student here at the School of Theology and the pastor of the St. Nicholas United Methodist Church in Hull, Massachusetts. Will has served on the board of directors of the Reconciling Ministries Network, and he's actively engaged in working for the full inclusion of GLBTQ people in the United Methodist Church.
Thank you. I'll begin by saying when I read the invitation to participate, I was grateful to see that it said I was being asked to speak from the heart. And I thought, I'm a Methodist preacher. I can do that. So if this sounds more like a prepared sermon and less like my attempt to respond off the cuff immediately, then you're welcome. The text for this sermon, which I have prayed about and studied, and which has disclosed to me a word from God, is seated directly next to me and was standing at the podium a moment ago, Bishop Talbert. Before saying how he has moved me, I want to start by naming something about my life. I want to start by admitting that I have a problem. There are two parts of my identity that I have trouble reconciling. It's not being Christian and gay. Those things go together very well for me. But I am referring to my dual identity around the United Methodist Church. Here's where I'm going. I am someone who is committed to working on the technical problems of running the United Methodist Church, and I'm also a parish pastor. This is a conflict for me because being in ministry in our denomination, in a local church, and then denominational management can create tensions in my life. What do I even call this side of the equation? You might say, I'm a bureaucrat. That's when I get elected and appointed to things, and when my agenda wins and votes, I'm a bureaucrat. But when it loses and I get kicked out, I become an activist. So whatever it is, it's being involved in the United Methodist Church and also serving people in a local church. This can create tension that I bet some of the pastors in the room can identify with. On the structure side of things with the church, we work to craft language that will pass committee votes. But then on the service side of things, every day of our lives, we tell people not to be held back by that sort of stuff. And we preach that they should instead learn to live with embodied integrity, no matter what the structure of the church says. On the structure side of things, we focus on votes at General Conference. But on the service side of things, we focus on lives in our community. This goes back and forth. On this side of things, we protest things that must change. And then over here, we help people follow Christ wherever they are, here and now. This side tries to organize activists. Very difficult. And this side just shares the gospel and lets it go free. So my problem comes down to this. I'm trying to serve people in a church that has enough issues all on its own. So at times I feel trapped by the reality of the limitations and the restrictions that are all around me in ministry. And also, I'm both a pastor and an activist involved in the church, and it's difficult for me. So plenty of people are much more trapped than I am, people who are in the closet, people who are just trying to take much smaller steps than reforming the Book of Discipline. You know, can I carry this sign in public? Can I wear a pin? Can I just tell the truth? This challenge is a reality. And I don't think that this challenge is going to go away in 2016 when we have our next General Conference of the United Methodist Church. In fact, I think things will probably get worse and continue to become more homophobic in our church structure. But this brings me to our guest of honor, Bishop Talbert. I give thanks to God for Bishop Talbert's words. In particular, I'm thinking his words on the last day of General Conference. I've got some of your words here. On that day, you very clearly said that derogatory, within the United Methodist Church, derogatory language and restrictive laws are immoral, unjust, and no longer deserve our loyalty and obedience. Our mandate to offer Christ and to be, as you have said, to be pastoral in the normal course of our pastoral ministry is a hope that's not based on our ability to solve all the technical problems of the United Methodist Church. And it's not focused on our ability to overcome all of the obvious issues that we face. But instead, the bishop is sharing a hope that connects us to God's faithfulness that is alive in us despite the distracting challenges of reality. Now, let me tell you a story that some of you lived with me. This is a good memory I have from General Conference 2012. There are some good memories from, don't worry, this is a good one. It took place during the second day of our holy conferencing, our second holy conferencing session. Some of you remember because you designed it, I think, that we had a few different conversations around key issues in the church. First, we had a conversation around sexuality. We had some issues in that conversation. Bullying and other bad things happened. Also signs of life, but there were some bad things that happened. But this conversation was, I think it was called Regional Issues, if I've got it right, where we divided up according to a geographic area on the globe. All the delegates from the United States of America were in the main convention center hall. And they were about to have their discussion about issues for people that are being faced in the United States of America. Now, picture this hall. I'm going to describe it for you. Not surprisingly, for the United Methodist Church, it was just a horrible structure. It was like an airplane hangar. I mean, it was a really, really, really difficult space. It was huge, 1,000 people seated here, and then way down far, if you look down that way, a long way away at the end of this cavernous rectangle was the stage. And that's where the microphones and the instruments and all the cameras were focused, way down there. That's where the podiums were, where the bishops sat, and where perhaps the power was. Then stretching backwards from them, reaching far, far away, were the people of God. just seemed to go on forever. You've heard of too big to fail. The structure was too big to function. It was a ridiculous space. Now, this meant, as those of us who were in the bleachers, as we looked much more prominent than the front, which you needed binoculars to find, were the long lines that marked the margins. I was in the bleachers. Who else was in the bleachers with me? Johnny, you were there, and many others. Many others were there. We were a church, as we looked from those bleachers, to my eyes, that were defined by straight lines that marked who's inside and who's outside. Now, we were off in the bleachers. At that moment, I was an activist, not a bureaucrat, and we were looking to interrupt and to make a witness. We didn't have access to the stage or to the microphones, but through our friend Marla Markham from the Better Future Project, we had the people's mic. Some of you know this from the Occupy movement. It's a call and response method where you take over with your voices. Here's what I'm getting at. When we spoke from the sidelines, in the bleachers, outside the lines, in that huge space, when we spoke, the room changed its shape. Because all of the delegates on that huge floor were called to bring their focus to a new point in the room, and the faces just turned. When our focus changes, we change. And once we spoke from the sidelines, we saw a transformation. What once were profiles suddenly became people. And I'm reminded what the bishop said about the chance that the cabinet created for people to sit down and have conversations, to look at each other. And in the bleachers, we realized that we had much more access to each other than we had led ourselves to believe. We learned we can do this. We just have to act like those obstacles do not exist. They do not deserve our obedience and our respect anymore. We can speak up and we can overcome some things. That time, and in this one situation, which is, you know, particular, we didn't get in any trouble at all. In fact, once we finished, they said, okay, right back to business. But once they did go back to business, I do remember, in my memory anyways, some of the delegates finding within themselves permission to walk off the floor and come join us up in the bleachers. They were attracted by the joy of telling the truth from where you stand. There's nothing like it in the world. When we speak a truthful word that is relevant to the moment, we give permission for people to be free. We reach people who the power structure simply cannot reach. And even if they could reach, they wouldn't know how to communicate with them to begin with. So don't worry about that, because they're so hindered by their own sense of structure. Okay, now we'll have a little bit of fun with this, if you all don't get too excited. With some quick examples from the Bible and from Methodist history and from life and ministry. First, I just want to say, remember my problem about wrestling with structure and having the opportunity to be in service. And apply what the bishop said in the Altar for All call to obedience statement. Unjust structures no longer hold our respect, and we can just focus on the normal course of pastoral ministry. Then we can be obedient. I just have one issue with that phrase, Bishop, in the phrase, the normal course of pastoral ministry, and that is the use of the word normal. There is no such thing as a normal course of pastoral ministry. When we behave as if the all too real restrictions, obstacles, and divisions that are built up by sin are not worth comparing to the power of God who is really in control, we may not be normal, but we are faithful. And when we are obedient to the God who really rules the world around us, we bring a new focus and are no longer just so many profiles out there in the chaos. I'm glad you're about to stand, okay? But we ourselves are transformed into being full persons God calls us to be. Allow me to quickly summarize here. I just want to go through some of these. You're going to like this. The Hebrew midwives in Egypt, do you remember them? When they realized that it was up to them to defy death, to love life, and to break the law, they were being obedient to the God who really rules this world. Whenever people who are thirsty and have no money but come to the waters anyway and drink, they are defying the restrictive laws that serve no purpose other than oppressing outsiders. Do you see where I'm going with this? When her soul magnified the Lord, she herself was demonstrating that the unjust and pointless limitations that others had built up just to keep her down were not going to prohibit her any longer. When Peter fell into a trance
just long enough to start to hear voices that freed him from being forced to live divided any longer. He was remembering where his loyalty really lies. We're almost there. Don't forget, every Methodist knows this story. When a neurotic, emotionally tortured young man can let go of his own issues and psychological self-defense mechanisms long enough to feel that his heart is strangely warmed, then he is behaving as if the old internal obstacles don't have power over him anymore. Hold this example very tenderly, friends. When a stranger in your community, a newcomer from somewhere else who doesn't know anyone else, stands up on a Sunday morning in front of a room full of strangers, and despite all the immorality and injustice and restrictions that the world throws at them, when they are asked, perhaps by you, do you confess Jesus Christ as your Savior, put your whole trust in his grace, and promise to serve him as Lord in union with the church, which God has opened to people of all ages, nations, and races? And then they are ridiculous enough to say, I do. Then they are behaving as if every pointless rule in this world no longer exists. So I hope that sharing from the heart has allowed you to share in a little bit of the joy that I know through Bishop Talbert's witness. Thanks.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight, we heard a lecture by Bishop Mel Talbert titled Human Rights, Dissenting Action, and Civil Discourse. Bishop Talbert's lecture was followed by a response from Pastor Will Green of St. Nicholas United Methodist Church in Hull. Tonight's event was presented by the Boston University School of Theology and Office of Development and Alumni Relations in association with the Lowell Institute. Our moderator was School of Theology Dean Mary Elizabeth Moore. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.